This is a tape one, side two, Vic Jackson interview, 1-15-91. If we can, I'd like to, if you can recall, pin that down a little bit more specifically about what some of the issues were there. Was the General Schriever and the BMD trying to develop in the case of Minuteman, a missile that would do a fairly narrow kind of job, and Rand was arguing for something different and something that was, as you put it, more flexible. Was that the issue, or was it something a little bit different than that?
It may be a mixture of both. Rand was apprehensive that this point design system depended on everything working just right to be able to do its job successfully. And nothing ever works. A variety of things don't all mesh together that nicely with new technology. The propulsion system won't give you the specific impulse you need. The missile casing is going to weigh more than you planned it would, so your payload will be less. Your accuracy will not be as good as you think it is, so this very small warhead won't be able to do a useful job for you, and so forth. And besides, it's all going to cost more than you think it is. And the pressures from the contractor and the military are to minimize those problems, if you will, and get on with it. And granted, this is not made explicit, at least to me, granted the first one may not work very well. The first one of anything never works very well. But there's a chance to improve it, and the second one, and the technology 5 years from now will bail you out, and we'll have a useful weapon system 5 years from now, even if we won't have it starting on year one. So I guess I'm hard-pressed at the moment to be more specific on how the issues were drawn, but I do recall Rand making the point that if you're justifying this system on this performance and justifying it on these costs, then you're wrong, because it's not going to perform that way, at least at the beginning, and it's going to cost much more than you think it is.
Okay. Now, there may be I don't know whether this is an issue or not, but let me just throw it out. I mean, by this period, the Air Force is developing some internal expertise and appreciation of technical problems. Raymel Wooldridge was there with a very capable technical staff, and Rand was there with a very capable technical staff. What was your sense of how these issues, where you've got essentially sets of experts on both sides, if you will, work themselves out? I mean, how do these issues get discussed and the merits assessed of these different points of view?
I don't think I can answer your question. That got resolved above my pay grade. Okay. I suspect that's the kind of things that Frank Kolbaum and Benny Schriever did getting together, or when we had our Air Force Advisory Group meetings, and there'd be people from the Air Staff and maybe General Schriever and who all there, they would talk about all this. And I suspect that much of the petty bickering, the not invented here syndrome kind of thing that engaged our individual research staff members and TRW research staff members, I suspect that got glossed over and recognized as being a minor nuisance at higher levels.
Okay. How long did you, stay in that kind of liaison capacity and devoted most of your time to ballistic missile issues?
About 3 to 4 years. From before the first IRBMs and ICBMs flew till after they began to deploy the initial operational capability. It was over that period of time, so I was on the job when the first successful flight tests occurred and so forth.
So this would be into the early 60s, is that, are you talking with the Minuteman or with just the...
No, these were the liquid propellants at the time, the Atlas and the Titan, and then the spin-off of the IRBM, the Thor, using the components that had been developed for the others. So these were the late 50s, and again, I'd have to refresh my memory on the flight test. But,
okay.
But again, I was there and on the scene in this job at the days the paper battles about the Minuteman were being fought, and which is that a good idea, and are you committing yourself to development and production too early, or should you wait and get more capability? And then on top of all this, or informing all this debate, was all the political development of strategy and assured destruction and massive retaliation, and what did you think you were trying to ask of your forces? And Rand, as I recall, was strong in arguing that massive retaliation, that kind of anti-city capability, is surely not adequate. That may be all you can do at the beginning, but that will not soon, or that the monopoly we have, the rationale for that use of forces, you know, that's all going to go away. So there are other arguments for giving yourself more payload flexibility, the ability to carry penetration aids, because you can see defenses evolving and so forth. So,
okay. Now, just to be clear, where you were sitting in the in the RAND organization when you were doing this work in the latter half of the 50s, what department were you working out of at that point? I think at that by the second half of the 50s, they had the various technical departments had kind of been drawn together under an engineering roof.
The structure was a divisional structure when I first came. There was aircraft division, a missiles division, electronics division, social science division, and so forth. And then there were departments within those divisions. A major reorganization occurred when Ed Barlow became head of the so-called engineering division. And the next level down was, again, departments. And this fellow, Jim Digby, was head of an...
I think that was called operations.
Operations research or something other. I forget exactly. But I was sitting in that department, the engineering division, at the time I moved into the ballistic missile area. As I recall, a man named Dale Oyster took over from Jim Digby as head of that particular system operations department. So I worked for Dale for several years. But I was a member of the research staff. I was never a part of RAND management or administration except in this liaison role.
For the late 50s, I was reading some newsletters that A.S. Mengele prepared on military RAND activities, and it was kind of a conduit just for keeping everybody informed what was going on between the organizations. And I ran across a couple of references of work you were doing on mobile systems as compared to fixed systems that were also hardened. What do you recall of the kind of considerations that went into assessing these various options for basing the missile systems?
The push towards mobility was driven by vulnerability. As our missiles got more and more accurate, as we could see their missiles getting more and more accurate, then any fixed site on the ground you want to aim at is going to be destroyed. So you don't want to be there if war is going to come. In order to survive, you've got to be deep underground or not where the warhead goes off, and that means mobility. So that was the primary consideration. But then you quickly encountered all the other factors, the feasibility and the infrastructure that would support movement of whatever it is you're talking about moving, the safety features, how do you do this in peacetime, how do you arrange to operate high operational cost system in peacetime in a way that ensures you the survivability you want. If you're dependent upon warning in some way to activate this mobile system, how do you assure yourself that you get that warning? So it's this cluster of considerations that have essentially defeated any mobile strategic system and mobile ballistic missile system in the United States. We never persuaded national leaders that we'd solve all these problems enough.
Do I recall correctly from this period that RAND was an advocate of mobile systems? Is that correct?
No, I don't think RAND was an advocate so much as we were studying it. I was a project leader on a mobile missile system at one time, and I don't think we were at the point yet of advocating. We just wanted to learn. We wanted to see what the problems were. We could compile horrendous threats, as other people do still today. If the threat's this bad, then you have to pay that price. You have to go mobile. So you could identify circumstances in which you say, yep, we think this is the way to go if A, B, C, D, E occur, if that future world looks like that. But if the future world is a different world, then you still don't want mobile systems, perhaps. And woven through all this was a point of view that I came to appreciate as I got older, as a consequence of my political science, if you will, perspective, that the world was much more stable. Neither the United States nor the Soviet Union wanted to go to nuclear war. Many, many people, not just Bernard Brody, saw that earlier, very early on. And all of this technological, you know, fancy dance, you know, fancy footwork kind of thing, was all part of the background that was part of the price of admission of playing the game, of being a first-class power in some sense. We had to explore all these options. We had to know that there were no surprises out there, that they couldn't do things that, you know, they could do things that we couldn't do and so forth. So both of these, all this ongoing activity, some kind of precise balance in their capability and ours wasn't necessarily required. If you're within 50%, you know, that's enough that no one's going to start a war out of the blue and so forth, because you have some expert gives you a 10%, our capability is 10% greater than his. So I think I learned over the years that much of the reason for investigating and looking at mobile systems, for example, was not to come out and strongly advocate. We were just building our capital knowledge, building our knowledge of what the future world might look like and what the important distinctions and characteristics would be. And it just isn't important to have a 10% advantage over the other guy if you're talking strategic nuclear war, that, if that's relevant to your question.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that point was generally appreciated at the time that we're talking
about. I think
about.
That's correct. I think you're correct.
Yeah. That raises another question that goes back to the time when you first came to RAND. There seems to be some indication from documents and some discussions that I've had that there was a certain sense among the RAND staff, especially in the early 50s after Korea, that a general war with the Soviet Union was practically inevitable, and there was sort of a sense of people were trying to predict when this might happen. Do you recall that kind of feeling or discussion when you were at RAND when you first came here, or any period in the 50s when you were working?
I think I can say no, unequivocally. I do not recall RAND people trying to predict when the war might occur, or that necessarily the war was inevitable. That there was always a high concern of blundering into war, doing foolish things, or unauthorized launches, or accidental launches, or, you know, accidents themselves that have been misinterpreted. There were all the horror stories about early radar, you know, our warning radar picked up the moon coming over the horizon and reported that as an incoming raid of bombers and so forth. So it was too easy to imagine that war might occur, but not because it would be a rational choice. And all the work on permissive action links and positive control and all of those things, especially with missiles, were things that were done to minimize the possibility, the probability of accidental launches, unauthorized launches, and so forth.
Okay. Getting back to the mobile basing studies for a moment. So the just to be clear, the conclusions, if you will, that you came up with as part of the study were more in the way of assessing the options and under what circumstances there might be some value in going to a mobile system. Is that a fair characterization?
After, in some way, assessing its feasibility, is it indeed feasible to talk about that? Is there anything connected with ballistic missiles or warheads or whatever that absolutely says, you know, forget this, it just cannot be done? And there were problems with the guidance system. The guidance systems, the kind we had in those days, were designed to be set someplace and calibrated and aligned and all that. So the Minuteman guidance would have had to have been changed if they went to a mobile Minuteman, for example. But okay, that's just, you know, that can be done. You satisfy yourself it can be done. Okay, now do we want to do it? Or under what conditions might we want to do it? So yes, after assessing feasibility, then it was the conditional context that was of concern.
And was the assessment that it was feasible to?
Oh yes, surely, yeah. Surely,
okay.
Surely.
I thought.
Again, with not necessarily with the existing hardware, But if you're going to design a mobile system, you would have the 5 or 7 years of lead time to do different things with the guidance system and to arrange calibration checkpoints every so many miles down the railroad track or whatever you needed to do, solve the problem. But yes, it was feasible.
There was some keen interest, I think this is fair to say, in the Air Force about what was going on in the Navy Polaris program during this period. Did you have any from the RAND side, any involvement in looking at what was transpiring in the Navy program and how it related to Air Force interests?
In a couple different ways. And one had to do with what is the competition in terms of force mix kinds of issues. Is the Navy likely to take over the strategic role because it's presumably invulnerable if it's on submarines and so forth? And what can its systems do? Granted, the submarines introduce a degree of invulnerability that fixed land bases don't have. Can you get a useful weapon system to fly out of a submarine? So there was that. There was also the same technology that let the Navy have small ballistic missiles of, say, like the Polaris type that were, first of all, quite limited in range. You could foresee improvements in missile technology that would give you ICBM capabilities in envelopes of roughly the same size. So I recall a fair amount of concern about when could one move to a truck mobile ICBM system, a smaller missile that you could put on trucks and inherit a larger mobile grid of roads, if you will, as distinct from the railroad infrastructure that would help support a Minuteman mobile system. So yes, we were interested in several aspects of the Navy systems.
One set of issues that began to come to the fore in the late 50s with the advent of the missile systems was issues of arms control. And there was some beginning discussion of that set of issues here at RAND and how they might affect the Air Force programs. Did that ever enter into the work that you were doing?
It entered at least indirectly, and it entered into RAND's consideration, but not enter into mine. I personally am not a fan of arms control. I think arms control is a delusion. Arms are not the source of the arms competition between the Soviet Union and the United States. It's a political dispute that raises the least arms competition. And as long as that political dispute is there, arms control agreements are going to be minimally important, it seems to me. Now, I'm in a minority saying that. I recognize that. But I have deliberately chosen not to work on arms control projects problems here at RAND. And I think recent history would support me that we were reaching agreements with the Soviet Union on arms control after the threat in some way damps down, not because the arms control helps damp the threat. But that's maybe not the answer that is relevant.
Yeah. Okay.
But yes, RAND was concerned about that. RAND, early on, to the extent that would influence the political context in which decisions were made about U.S. weapon systems, RAND wanted to understand that. So there were active projects here at RAND looking at arms control, yes.
Okay. When did you mentioned that the RAND environment, in a sense, stimulated your interest in getting a broader perspective on military programs and that you pursued a degree in political science. Was that during this period in the 50s or later that you initiated that formal course of study?
It began when I was on active duty here. And when I became exposed to the writings of people like Bernard Brody and Harvey D. Weird and Hans Speyer and some of those early historian political scientist types, I said, gee, I need to know more about that. So Bernard Brody acted as almost an unofficial faculty advisor for me for a couple of years, suggested reading things. I read everything that he wrote. So I was a very avid reader in those days. But then it occurred to me that my approach may have been too much of a dilettante, and I should be more systematic about it. So that's what led me to go back to UCLA, and I began my UCLA work after I left the Air Force. Maybe I was still here, but I was on the way out of the Air Force when I began my coursework at UCLA.
So this would have been the mid-50s then that you...
Mid-50s. Okay. Yes.
Most of the kinds of issues you were working on were primarily technical. How much did you follow the developing discussions and debates within RAND about the proper framework for strategic doctrine?
Well, as much as I could. I found that opened so many windows for me. I found just fascinating that I, as a technical person, needed to know or wanted to know more about that larger context in order to do a better job. So I have evolved away from my technical base. I build upon my technical base, if you will. But the issues I've addressed at RAND over the years have become broader and less technically oriented. I've gotten involved, for example, in this history of the arms competition that the Department of Defense requested several years ago. I've gotten involved in civil defense studies. I've gotten in a variety of things that move away, if you will, from narrow technical issues to the larger, to a larger context. Partly because of my own design. I found that the most relevant thing, the most fascinating and new and exciting.
This may seem like an overly simple question, but how did you follow these things? I mean, what were your avenues for appreciating what was going on? Was it, you know, going to people's offices and talking to them, bumping in the halls, sitting down with people at lunchtime, meeting people after work? How did you were aware of the ferment of discussion that was going on?
All the above.
Okay.
Yes. In those days, to come back to now administration and management and control, when our support largely came from the Air Force throughout most of the 50s, Air Force and Atomic Energy Commission throughout the 50s, there was a much more simple to the worm's eye view, internal organization control. We didn't fill out timesheets. We reported up through a project leader or a group leader. There were no deadlines. There were no project monitors within the government that required periodic reports and so forth. So there's a much more permissive operational environment here at RAND. I could go to any, you know, and seminars were widely advertised. Bernard Brody and others would be debating something or other, or going to talk about what they know about something. And the RAND staff was invited to go. So there's a much looser control with much greater opportunity to put your nose in someone else's business. And you could even take the time, you know, I learned something at that meeting that I disagree with, so you go back to your office and you write a document, was our internal name for the thing at the time.
Right.
And there, any briefing, any seminar, it would rain documents for 3 weeks after as participants, you know, shouted at each other, you're wrong, or you forgot this point, and so forth. So this documentary ferment was, again, a stimulating environment. It gave you a chance to see, you know, hear someone make his case, and then read the follow-up. Some more reasoned, more thoughtful support, more reasoned, more thoughtful disagreement, and have a chance to, you know, have lunch with people or meet them in the hall or whatever. So it was that array of opportunities, if you will, that I'd be hard-pressed to name one, except that RAND has suffered in recent years and has lost much of that. As we've gotten more carefully defined projects, as we've gotten a variety of sponsors, each of whom wants to see things come along, as we've gotten majors and lieutenant colonels assigned as project officers in the Pentagon, the opportunity to spend time looking at putting your nose in the other guy's business has gone down. Our sponsor wants his 100% of the time, you know, on his project, and anything over that, you're free to spend, but you're not free to step over the traces. That's a complaint I would make, and I detect many people in the RAND staff making, as one of the ways that RAND has changed over the years for the worse.
Okay.
You probably heard that before.
Yeah. Did you find yourself, you know, others have kind of written about some of these strategic issues, and I'm kind of more interested in them, not so much for the particular strands of thinking that were developed, but just what they represent about the RAND culture and kind of the passing around of ideas. Did you find yourself, you know, more sympathetic with one school of thought than another? I mean, there's, you know, the basic characterization is that, you know, Bernard Brody represented a certain set of views, and Wallstetter and Hermann Kahn as the three kind of representative poles of thought here. Did you find yourself more sympathetic or attracted to posing the problems and the issues in light of one of those thinkers?
I probably don't recall exactly the person with whom I associate most or the time which I did it, but I do recall coming down within the so-called warfighting camp, if you will, as distinct from the massive retaliation deterrence kind of camp. That the massive retaliation capability may indeed be a necessary capability to deter the other guy from doing something to you of the same kind, but it's not sufficient. We need the ability to use even strategic nuclear forces more carefully, more specifically, more explicitly, more controlledly. And the argument here now is the familiar one, that military strength confers power in wartime because you can use it, but it confers peacetime political power through perceptions of what would happen if it were used, and excuse me, if it were used and if it could be used. And now, a force that can be aimed only at cities and used that way has essentially no political utility. Whereas a force that can reach out, and I don't want to be saddled with the surgical attack notion with nuclear weapons, but a force that can be used in some controlled way is, from as long as I can recall, seemed much more useful and better to me than the force that was different. Now, exactly where that fit in the hierarchy of the three people you mentioned, or the triumvirate of the three people you mentioned, and their arguments and how they changed over time, I couldn't reconstruct on the spur of the moment. But,
okay, but I guess what I hear you saying is that you found the discussion stimulating and you kind of formulated your own point of view. It sounds
closest
to some of the things that Herman Kahn
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. In fact, I became almost dismayed with Brody in his later years and some of his attitudes, that however much I loved the man and however much I owed him personally and so forth.
Now you had sitting here at Rand had a pretty sophisticated and current kind of view of problems, both technical and strategic and political. I'm curious, when you were at UCLA doing your coursework, how you kind of saw the handling of political issues. Given your experience in the military and here at RAND, did you kind of feel that they were kind of providing you with a useful set of tools, or was there some sense in which you felt they just really weren't terribly up to the minute in the problems you were concerned with?
Both. They were giving me tools, but they were not up on the problems. UCLA at that time, from the late 50s up to, I finally got my degree in 62, as I recall, because I was only going part-time. They had no formal military policy program or studies or whatever it was. They were organized in the traditional, classic way of political science departments. There were six different fields: international relations, public administration, foreign affairs. I didn't pick what they were now. Political theory. So we had to take courses in each of those areas and pick two or three of them as an area of specialty and so forth. So at first I was disappointed, but by hindsight again, I was more pleased. Let's see what the discipline has to offer, and let me learn enough about the political science view of the world, and let me apply it later on. Let me see what they can teach me. So the same things that led me over to do the academic work made me appreciate, maybe it was too big a loss not to have them focus me. Let me do my own focusing.
Did you have to write a thesis as part of that program?
Yes.
Do you recall what your subject was?
Yes. In fact, I recall. Well, it was the military policy of the United States in the nuclear era. And there were many people in the USA faculty, others who argued that, you know, we finished war. You know, war is no longer plays a role in U.S. national policy, that it's a thing of the past and so forth. I said, that's not true. there is a U.S. policy that uses war as a meaningful instrument of satisfying our objectives and so forth. It's not that one ever goes to war for gain, as you might have done back in the 17th century or something or other. But nevertheless, we still did have a useful policy about war. There was a role for war. We were preparing to go to war if we had to. And it was a mistake to be so terribly negative about and say that there is no, or the U.S. policy is totally negative about war, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying this very well, perhaps. But, yeah. And I recall getting involved in that debate because one of my My original thesis advisor left to go to the Soviet Union for a liaison of some sort, and the guy replaced him was very hostile to my approach. And he essentially turned thumbs down on one version of my thesis, and it was when my original guy came back that I finally succeeded in satisfying all their hurdle jumping requirements.
All right. Did you have the discussions about the strategy and warfighting capability and the missile basing work that you were working on tie into to one of the major studies of the period that Ed Barlow worked on, the Strategic Offensive Forces study? Were you associated with that activity at all?
Only on the fringes, I recall. I think I was still involved in liaisoning over with the Ballistic Missile Division, I think I recall right. by that time. And that kept me, say, half the time over there. I did not have the opportunity to work full-time on that particular study. I recall being well aware of it and maybe contributing things along the way or making sure that people that were working full-time had access to data and so forth. But no, I was not a full-time member of that project.
Okay. Also during this...
Bill Kaufman is along the way. Also, either took over from Barlow or conducted a follow-on study of strategic offensive forces. And
I think he was certainly one of Barlow's deputies or something on that effort, or one of the mm-hmm. leaders of the subgroups.
And Bill's still around. You may have already talked with him.
I haven't, but he is around. I'm aware of that. Also during this period of the latter half of the 50s at RAND, Herman Kahn and Ed Quaid developed the systems analysis course. Did you participate in that at all, either as in formulating it or in taking the course, and or just kind of directing your attention to the questions of systems analysis again?
I participated in it, and I, for several months, gave the final lecture in the course. I just completed a study of what the preferred next generation ICBM should look like, and they used my study as the final summary. You spent 2 weeks now learning about parameterizing this and optimizing that and linear equations this and developing costs and building a model and so forth. And they said, okay, now let us show you one. So over the years, RAND used a recent study as its final example, and I was that recent study for a period of, let me say, 6 months or so. So I did not participate in developing the course, but I was drawn upon in this way.
I guess it might be interesting then to ask for the study that you were presenting, in what ways did it kind of follow the model of systems analysis, and what ways did it perhaps differ from it? I mean, I would assume that it was a vehicle for getting the students to kind of appreciate some of the complexities of the systems analysis technique and approach.
I would answer that it was quite consistent with whatever the school solution to systems analysis happened to be. Whatever the emphasis might have been different, if we're estimating future technology, then maybe more parameterizing of uncertainty there. And if performance comes out this way, then here are the implications if performance comes out that way. So maybe there was more iffiness to it in that particular dimension. But I don't recall a single way in which that would differ from the school, the textbook approach to systems analysis.
Okay. I guess an interesting question there would be, how did you come to be a textbook example of the systems analytic approach? Clearly this wasn't something that had really been codified in RAND. I mean, it was something that was more learned by example than by a textbook.
Okay, I guess osmosis may be the answer. My earlier comments suggested that I found this approach to life, extremely useful, appropriate, intellectually challenging, so forth. So I absorbed all that I could, and it must have worked or something. And it could be that my participation in various ways along this route was more explicit or more careful than I recall. Maybe I did get involved in helping people, helping structure the course, or I don't recall, but maybe I did. I can't explain why I happened to have that particular package of things that proved useful at the time.
Yeah, well, one of the studies that during this period and later that was cited as another important exemplar of systems analysis was Wohlstetter's basing study. Was that something that you studied or referred to as a model or an example of good systems analysis?
No, not in this particular study that I did, and not in the report that I made of it to the course people. But
I'm thinking more as background, as you were kind of beginning to appreciate and develop your own skills in using systems analysis.
Yes, I think so. I was involved a little bit in some of Wohlstetter's basing study thing, but not very much, because the emphasis there was not upon aircraft and how they operated and the range capability. It was on the basing. So our civil engineer type people, our shelter type people, played a larger role in what's feasible for basing of aircraft. And there were questions about dispersal and how do you change your maintenance logistic support structure if you disperse from the wing level of 45 airplanes down to three different squadrons of 15 airplanes each or so forth. So there were those kinds of operational and command and control communications dimensions of it that I got involved with peripherally, but I did not play a major role in that in Wohlstetter's study, no.
Okay. As somebody who came from an Air Force background, RAND staff come to you, or did they engage you in discussions about the RAND Air Force relationship? What I'm thinking of in particular is that certainly by the late 50s, there was a renewed concern. At least it appears from documentation about the RAND Air Force relationship and where it was going, and there seemed to be kind of a crisis point in 58-59. For example, Ed Lindblom was brought in and did a series of very extensive memos on the subject for Charlie Hitch and Frank Kolbaum, and there were other people who were contributing to essays on the same subject. Did you get involved in this set of concerns about the character of the RAND Air Force relationship and some of the problems that were perceived?
No, I did not get involved. I may have been aware of some of the problems and I may have read some of the correspondence back and forth, their memos, but because of my worm's eye view, I came to RAND as a first lieutenant. I made captain while I was here. I was a captain when I left. And I did not have the prior extensive experience within the military structure. You know, I came in as a civilian after the Korean War, or I was a civilian when the Korean War started. And I had no prior commissioned service before that period of time. So I got into the Research and Development Command. I gained a perspective of the breadth of their activities by being in the position I had within the so-called Office of Scientific Research. But I was not a source of good information about air staff interaction and bureaucratic politics and RAND relationships and so forth. No, I was not drawn into that.
These things, you know, the tensions as they were perceived came through in at least a couple of arenas when RAND and the Air Force had to communicate with one another. One was in these kind of liaison activities where there was direct and extended contact between RAND staff members and the Air Force, and the other was through the medium of briefings, in which you had to sit down with an audience and talk to them and be able to communicate with them in an effective way. You've described some of your liaison activity, and I get the impression it was, you know, fairly straightforward, and there were no great difficulties in exchanging points of view and approaches to solving problems and that kind of thing. Is that a...
There were incidents that arose along the way that caused a fair amount of difficulty and anguish at times. I recall, for example, being in meetings when we were looking for flight test results, let's say, and the people who were processing the data from where they saw things impact and so forth were still doing their thing. And some of our prima donnas would accuse them of withholding data from us, and if you don't give us that data soon, I'm going to go to Benny Schriever personally. And he's talking now to a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, who would never say Benny Schriever, he'd say General Schriever. So I recall people at RAND pulling rank and raising problems like that, and then my colonel friend would get me off on the side and say, Vic Jackson, can't you find some way to keep that guy at home? Or don't you realize you just set back our cooperative results 3 months, because now that those guys are never going to give that guy information he wants. You know, they're going to fight him, just personalities to get involved and so forth. I recall things like that. I recall stories about briefings given to SAC when General LeMay, a fairly strong personality, was in charge, and there'd be controversies arise and anguish. So as liaison representative in that, when I was doing that particular thing, I would get feedback from my colonel friend about the problems that he saw in RAND Air Force Relations, and what could we do to solve that, and So I go down the hall and talk to the guy for a half hour and stroke him, or he'd stroke me, and we'd arrange to exchange information, or if so-and-so was persona non grata, how can we get what needs, do what needs to be done and minimize those personality conflicts. So it was not a smooth, tranquil job all the time. There was more of this in it than I would like to have seen, to the sense that deflected or consumed time that could have been spent better doing something else.
Did you go back to your RAND colleague who may have, caused a problem and say, this isn't the best way to handle it, or, did you work that side of the perceived problem as well?
Well, I tried some of that, but again, my role had to be kind of limited. I was a junior RAND type and a junior staffer and a junior officer. So, yes, I would do that. More of what I did was, I guess, to report to Arnold Mengel and Bob Belzer and make sure they were aware of what these problems were, so they could make sure that Frank Kolbaum knew what he had to know to be ready. When he got the phone call from General Schriever about so-and-so, we wanted to keep Frank informed. We wanted to... So I guess I worked as much or more with Mengel and Belzer than I... I'm going to say much or more with them as I did with the staff, but that's not true. But I don't recall how I would assign an allocation of effort.
Okay, I'm at the end of a tape here. Let me stick another one in here if you're willing to go.
Sure.
Okay.